What is going on, everybody? Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. I'm your host, Curry Blanford, and today I'm talking to Sean Palmer. So Sean is a pastor, and he recently released a book called 40 Days on Being a Three. And if you have listened to much of this show, you know that I love Enneagram and that I'm an Enneagram 3, and I talk a lot about that. Sean comes on today to talk about his book because he's also an Enneagram 3 and wrote this book that's just some short exercises and thoughts for 40 days on being a 3. There's other parts of this series. I think the 2 is out by now. It's just really cool, though. And in this interview, we get into what being a pastor was like, Sean's vocation, but we really get into what it's like to be a 3. And it's really, really fun to talk about being a 3 in this episode. This is a great, really fun episode where you learn a lot about being a 3. So if you know a 3, if you know me, you're going to find out a lot in this episode about what makes them tick and just all of that. There's also a lot of vulnerability in this because when you're talking about your number, you're talking about things that you really struggle with. And so I talked to Sean about some things that I struggle with and some ways to kind of maybe flip the switch on some of those or change my patterns of behavior on some of those things. And so there's just a lot to this episode. It's a ton of fun. Sean is awesome. And yeah, I think you're going to get a lot out of this one, especially if you love Enneagram. So before we get started, I just want to remind you to make sure you're following me on Instagram and Facebook at Theology of Hustle and on Twitter at Curry Blanford to stay up to date with what we got going on the show. You can also check out my channel Bootleg Bible College on YouTube just for some basics behind theology and Bible. Right now, I'm working through a series on interpretation of the Bible. And so I encourage you to check all that out. And I hope you enjoy hearing from Sean. All right. Well, Sean, thanks so much for coming on the podcast and making time for you, man. This is super cool to connect.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to meet you. And this has been fun just getting to talk a little bit before we start press record, I guess.
Totally agree. So let's just maybe jump off with you sort of introducing yourself to everybody a little bit.
Okay. Well, my name is Sean Palmer, and I am teaching pastor at Ecclesia Houston here in Houston, Texas. And so we are a multi-site church, a lot of Gen Xers, millennials, and Gen Zers around. We were about a little over 20 years old. This church was planted by my friend, our lead pastor, Chris C. And so I do that. I write. I'm a speaking coach as well. I work with some local city governments on some other issues. My wife is a fifth grade school teacher. We have 2 daughters, 16 and 13. So that's been fun. And just sort of, I'm a child of the church. I was raised in the church in Mississippi and Georgia, and then eventually in Texas. And that is kind of us in a nutshell. I'm not super complicated of a person. but yeah, we enjoy a decent life with people that we love and love to work with and a church that we really enjoy a lot.
Yeah, I love that. I resonate with that a lot. That's good stuff. Okay. So like being a pastor, right? I mean, that calls to ministry and that sort of thing always sort of fascinate me. So can you talk a little bit about the trajectory you took and like even understanding like, hey, like vocational ministry is what I want to do or am called to do? Or
yeah. I mean, looking back at it now, it seems like it was the kind of thing that would have been inevitable for me, but I was raised in the church and I was that kid in church who didn't know that Sunday school wasn't like regular school. And so we'd go to Sunday school and I took it seriously. Like I wanted to learn all of the thing. And I grew up in a tradition that was really insistent about knowing the Bible, about capturing the data of scripture, like
sure,
who people were, where they were. You know, I think probably by the age of 6 or 7, I could have outlined Paul's missionary journeys or something like that.
Right.
And so I took it seriously. Like when they were like, and like I'm a 3 on the Enneagram. So I loved rewards. So I loved like stickers for showing up and bringing your Bible. And like somewhere in my mom's house, like there are the little Fishers of Men awards that I won at PBS for bringing the most friends. That was just sort of, I just took it seriously. And so when I was in middle school, our family changed churches. We were actually, we merged with another church there outside of Atlanta, and they had a youth ministry. I'd always been in really small churches up until that point. This church was a lot bigger, and they had a youth ministry and a youth minister. And, you know, I was just really blessed to have a great youth pastor at that church who talked mostly about Jesus. I even had this conversation with my wife this morning as we were talking about some issues that we are seeing from some of our friends around what some folks label as purity culture. I said, you know, like this guy is my youth pastor's name was Van Conwell. Like, he never talked about any of that stuff. Like, I was insulated from so many of the things. Like he talked about Jesus and how Jesus treats other people. And so I went to, after I graduated high school, I decided I wanted to, we always had summer interns in our youth ministry. And a lot of those were from Abilene Christian University, and they had made a really deep impact on me. So I decided I wanted to go there to go to school because I decided I wanted to be around people like that.
Yeah.
And so I did. I was a political science major when I went to school. And I went on a music scholarship, and I was offered an internship that summer in doing youth ministry work. And so came back to my hometown, did the internship, and kind of made this deal with God that, hey, if I enjoy doing this summer, I'm going to come back and I'll change my major. And at my school, you could do an undergraduate degree in Bible. Which I actually would not suggest. I did not know because I was from a non-denominational denomination. I didn't really understand that most people get a regular degree, undergraduate degree, and then go to seminary. Like, so many people I knew had just a degree in Bible and they were out working in churches. So I came back, I changed my major, got a degree in youth and family ministry, and which is really ultimately closer to something like adolescent psychotherapy or something. I mean, it's
right.
With some Bible classes thrown in. And so I was kind of on my way, and I have, I've been in ministry, 23, 24 years now. And for the most part, it's been a blessing, and I did the right thing, but it was gradual, little over little, of folks encouraging me. I remember coming back when I first did that, internship, the way my youth ministry work that I was in had when I was in high school is that there were two couples that kind of adopted a class, and you were with them basically from seventh grade all the way through 12th grade. I mean, it's incredible investment on their part. And so because I had graduated, the couple that had led us through that process had re-upped. So they were back down with seventh graders again, kind of walking through. And I was asked to do a communion meditation at a junior high retreat because that's how we started the summer. And I went up and I did it. I didn't think it was anything particularly incredible. And I went and sat down by the lady who had been one of my volunteers. And she leaned over to me and said, "That was really good. You should be a preacher." Mm. Came in later to find out that, and I really do believe this, that one of the key understandings for people going into ministry is validation. Has anyone ever told you that you should do this? And if no one has, there is probably some communal discernment going on.
Right.
And that the, because I deeply believe that the Spirit of God is among the people of God. And that if God wants you to do something, not only will God call you God's self, but lead people in your life to affirm that calling.
Right.
And that doesn't always come early on. I've written multiple books at this point in my life, and it wasn't until I was 40 years old, right, that someone said, "You're a good writer." Hmm. But I felt led to it.
That's good stuff. I love talking about ministry, and I love talking about that. That word on sort of discernment on being, going into ministry. I feel like that's it's a call that I think takes a lot of discernment. And maybe I've been around people who have not, taking that discernment as seriously as they could have, or, you know, but it's yeah, it's hard. Yeah. Ministry, all that stuff. So that's a great story. Let's jump into Enneagram and your book. And I think we'll find ourselves in so many other places from sure. there, but, can you just talk about, the book you've recently released and yeah, all that?
Yeah. So, my latest book, which came out on October 6th, is 40 Days on Being a Three. And it's part of a series that IVP is doing around all of the Enneagram numbers. And the idea is that there are all of these people who have really found a lot of benefit from the Enneagram. And like, where do you go once you know your number? And how do you do that in a healthy way that is that's got some spiritually formative aspects to it?
Yeah.
And so I don't know how many Enneagram workshops or how much work that you've done around that particularly, but one of the things that I find almost universal is that people who study the Enneagram and really learn it enough to be able to speak intelligently about it, that everybody that I've ever met feels like their number isn't represented well when other people teach the Enneagram.
Okay. Yeah, right? Sure.
And like, there's so much nuance that's lost. And so the story that I've told multiple times is I did go to a workshop one time that was led by this guy, and he was an eight. Right. And so the difficulty of teaching the Enneagram is it's everything times nine. So if you spend 15 minutes on one thing, you got to do that nine times. But I don't know what was going on in his life or what was happening, but I mean, he spent an hour talking about eights in the most sympathetic way that I've ever heard anyone talk about eights. And then I crammed everybody else in. And I don't say that as a pejorative, but like, what would it be like to sit down with someone else who shares your number and walks you through what it's like? Because what happens with people frequently, and this is what I teach my preaching clients too, it's like, you tell your story so that other people can see their story in your story.
Right.
Because it helps everyone to name what's happening, to say like, oh, like that's what that is. And especially right. for threes like me, like to know that you're not alone in feeling that, in that experience.
Right.
That there are other people who have learned the same habits, who think they're getting away with the same tricks. And even more than that, what I have found just with the book being out a week now is that it's folks who are married to those people or parenting those people or grandparenting those people, working alongside of them, that have found the book most helpful. So a mentor of mine texted me and he said, I sat down, I started reading your book out loud to my wife. And she just gave me, her eyes just cut to me. And I was almost like, this is what I've been experiencing of you. And this is what I've been telling you about you all of this time. And that's just really remarkable. So it's like, it's a book for Enneagram threes, but it's really a book for Enneagram threes and anyone who loves an Enneagram three. And so when you start to kind of extrapolate, like regardless of where you identify on the Enneagram, you're really dealing with five numbers, right? So right. you're dealing with your wings. So if you're a three or a two or four, and then you're dealing with your stress and security numbers or integration, disintegration, or whatever language that you want to use. So that's actually five numbers. So if you intersect with any of these numbers, like I'm really interested in Hunter's book because he's a two. Hunter mm-hmm. Mobley's writing a book on twos. So all of those spaces, especially if you're a three, six, or a nine, because you are the core numbers of the Enneagram or the shock points. And, you know, Richard Rohr and Claudio Naranjo would say that you're always moving, like you're in constant movement, those three numbers. So it's one of those things that seems like it's just kind of really narrow, but it's not for folks who know how the Enneagram works and how it can be a blessing for other people. So it's 40 days, 40 reflections. If I had to sit down and write 40 more reflections, there would be some similarity and a lot different. I mean, like these reflections, if you know the publishing process, like it was last year this time that I was writing a lot of those.
Right.
So yeah. I've changed some since then. I've realized some things. I've learned some things. But some of the struggles are absolutely identical, though they might have a little bit of different language.
Yeah, that's good. I got the book. I read the intro, which was very powerful. I did not, and you'll be proud of me, just read through the whole thing real, like, you know, I want to actually experience it, you know, as it should be experienced. I did read the first, you know, the first day.
Well, Kurt, let me tell you about that Here's what and obviously I have no idea who's bought and read the book, but feedback that I've gotten is one of two things. Like when I wrote it, I thought, I don't know very many threes who are going to stick with this for 40 days.
That's fair.
So I was like, maybe I'll write 25 of them and like the rest just be blank pages. Cause that's as far as the threes are going to get. But what's happened is most people that have talked to me have said either what you said, like I'm really trying to take them one day at a time, or that I just read it all. So, and what I'm also hearing is spouses, parents, all that, they're just sitting and reading it all, like, so there are exercises at the end of each day. I'm very confident that most threes will not do those exercises. Because it's time consuming, like just to sit down and read it for a three already feels like as much slowing as they're going to do today.
Right. Yeah, that's fair. I definitely experienced something similar. So yeah, that's good. Okay. So I guess a little background with me with Enneagram. So I read Richard Rohr's book, you know, way back in the day, you know? But I struggled finding my number. Like, I feel like Enneagram has gotten so just wildly popular, you know, it's kind of exploded and there's tests everywhere. I was reading before a lot of that stuff happened. Mm-hmm. And so it took me forever to figure out I was a three. I was like debating between like eight and like, am I a two? Like three just didn't sit right until like all of a sudden, like it like basically fell on me like a ton of bricks. Like, I really am an Enneagram three. And then the sort of devastation I think overtook, you know, like realizing, you know, I when you sit with your sin, I guess, and really understand it for the first time, was difficult for me. So can you just talk about like deceit being the core sort of, I'm not going to use the right word here, but the core sort of sin of the three. Right. Can you just talk about what that actually means?
Yeah, and I'm glad that you mentioned that, because a lot of people, I mean, half the threes I know had a hard time coming to their number or accepting that that was their number. Almost like, can we be, can we be anything else besides this? And I want to lay that on, I want to lay that on a couple of different, I want to blame a couple people for that. I really do want to blame whoever taught it to you. Because the odds are that you weren't taught it. You weren't taught that number by a three. And there are some teachers who say the aggressive stances, threes, sevens, and eights, like their numbers. I know very few threes who like their numbers.
Right.
Like when they first get, we come to appreciate it.
Right.
And so that's part of it. And the other part of it is that that core sin being deceit. Not only does that feel like I've been exposed in some ways,
right?
Is that threes aren't trying to deceive people, right? And it feels like you're saying that I'm deceitful,
right?
Not that I deceive, and nobody wants to be lay that on. And then it also projects to other people, right? That there's nothing about you that's authentic,
right?
Like, oh, you're core. So it's like, well, do I believe anything that I say or do? Do other people, if that's my core thing, like fours deal with envy, but no one's envious 24 hours a day. Like, it's almost like impossible. Right. Yeah. And so it feels like, and then if someone says like, that's really core to who you are. It's really central to who you are. So can I ever deal with it? So all that being said, what deceit really means in terms of three, and this is the way I talk about it in the book, is that our innate and deep desire to decrease shame, feel loved and accepted, and to be honored means that we give people what they want.
Right.
And so the person in front of us or the group in front of us gets what we intuit what they want. And you cannot do that all of the time without shading the picture. Without giving, this is, if you want me to be funny, then I'm going to be funny, even if I don't feel funny, like being funny today. If you want me to be insightful, I'm going to try and be insightful because that's what you want. And so is that central to who I am or how I'm feeling in the moment? Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But what is behind all that really isn't some sort of selfish desire. What's behind all that is to bless and serve the people or the person that's right in front of you, which is really a good and beautiful right. thing.
Yeah.
It only becomes bad when we, and this is what threes do, when we give ourselves away in order to please the person in front of us, because the word we have for pleasing the person in front of us, meeting their standard, exceeding their standard, is successful.
Right.
And so if I could tell threes anything, I was like, that desire that is in you to be of service and to be a blessing to people, to pull things together, like that's good. The piece that we have to work on is not giving ourselves away in the process, because that's deceitful. And the first person a three deceives is themselves.
Themselves, right? Yeah. Yeah, it's even hard for me to hear you talk about it like that. It's just like, I guess what I struggle with is, upon realizing that about myself, I realized that I don't know how to not be that.
Right.
Like it's not. Yeah. It's just who I am, and I don't know how to like change it,
you know? Right.
Like it's so core. And so I think I struggle with being like, there's such good things to being a three, like endless energy. I can do almost anything anybody asks me to do, except for understand my own emotions and even most of the right. time know what I want.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to even know like what I desire out of things, because it's always couched in somebody else's opinion of me.
Right. Right. And there are in the book, there are some practices around or that will help that. So what I want to say is like, that will never really go away. Sure. Right. But there are ways. So one of the things, like I used before COVID, I used to travel a lot. So I was gone out of town to a conference or speaking someplace about once a month. I mean, like a minimum of once a month. And I would spend so much time thinking about and preparing to pack. Like, what clothes do I need?
Right.
And I just really like clothes anyway, right?
Yeah.
And so what clothes do I need? Not like, what do I feel like wearing? Like, what do I need to wear at this event that right. will communicate whatever it is that I'm trying to communicate? Yeah. And I do think being a successful communicator, part of that job is the first job of a communicator is to gain a hearing. And some of those things matter. Like if you're going to a church, right, that is a suit and tie church and you show up there with ripped jeans, you know, that's not going to fly. But,
right.
But I mean, those times are really rare. Like, so I would spend time like watching online videos from that church, like to see what people there preach like, how they dress. Because I handle our guest speakers coming into Ecclesia, like we even have a document that we send them about how people dress and look at over here, you know, we want everybody to feel comfortable.
Right.
Okay. So I started a practice of giving myself 30 minutes about 30 minutes to pack.
Wow.
And when those 30 minutes are up, whatever I decided on, I've decided on. And that is a hedge against that. And like, so I still have a concern, right?
Sure.
But I'm moving away from the concern into a space of health about some of the issues around image, because I'm only going to give myself 30 minutes to pack. Like, I'm not going to be able to look at 14 different outfits. And, you know, I was the MC for a conference last year, and my family will make fun of me for this endlessly, and they should. But because of some of the other things that I had to take on that trip with me, I had to check a bag, which once I get to the place where I have to check a bag, I might as well take a big one.
Right. Right. Yeah, totally.
And so this was a 4-day conference. I was emceeing with another pastor, and every day I had not only a different outfit, but I had a different jacket for every day.
It's all about the jacket. Right? It's all about the jacket. Sean, I found my people. This is, yes.
So yes. They will say, like, my daughters will say, like, Dad, you have like 8 jackets and you have 3 gray jackets. And, and my co-MC, she wore jeans and a black blouse every day. Hair was in a ponytail, you know, the whole time. And like, there was a part of me that goes like that would be a healthy space for me to live in. I think that's right. Actually when I started doing the 30 minute thing, like, yeah. You know what? She just put in maybe 2 pair of jeans, maybe right. For 4 days. And then just 4 different black blouses, hair in a ponytail, hit it and go. And, you know, and was fine. She was fine.
I can't comprehend that. That makes no sense to me. My problem is always having enough space for shoes, right? I mean, like, if you're going to have the jacket.
Okay, right? I have a shoe story to tell you too.
Okay. All right.
So I was speaking a couple years ago in Southern California, and part of what this church was really generous. They flew out our whole family, put us in a hotel, and they said, here are some passes for Disneyland for 2 or 3 days. And so we all fly out there and like leave the day after school ends, like big family trip for the summer. And I make this joke during the sermon, because I'm doing a workshop that night, about how like we flew out here and it's me and my wife and 2 daughters. So it was like 6 bags. And one of those was just for shoes. Right. That was the joke I made. But in the last service, I think this church had 4 or 5 different gatherings on the weekend. In the last service, I said, I've been telling that joke all weekend, but the truth is, like, the bag for shoes, those were just my shoes.
Yes. I get that. Yeah. I get that so much. Because if you're going to wear the jacket, and it's going to be different every day, then the shoes need to like coordinate. Right. Right?
It's all got to tie it together. So this summer, what I decided to do is I would only wear black t-shirts. So if I'm leaving the house, I'm only wearing a black t-shirt. And like, I have these little sleeveless hoodies that I work out in. If I'm not leaving the house, that's what I'm going to wear.
Right.
And what it does is just like it over time, what it does is it trains that piece of you that thinks that this matters, because you realize it doesn't. A good friend of mine said to me, one of the best words for me ever was, what I wish I could tell Enneagram 3s is that so much of that is just unnecessary. Mm. Like, nobody cares.
Yeah.
Nobody cares. It's just unnecessary.
Yeah.
And I come back to that more frequently than I wish I had to.
Yeah, I get that. And I think that's a good word, and really a hard thing to come to the realization. Cause at the same time, I love all that stuff too. You know what I mean? And so like, where those things end and begin, I think is hard to sort of comprehend. One thing that I've been sort of dealing with, and maybe this just like this is like personal, like you're in the therapist seat now, you're something, you know, but I've realized recently that one thing that goes along with being a three and like needing others' expectations to experience love is that I can be a real coward about like important things, you know what I mean? Just even the racial conversation, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I have no questions where I stand. Like I've been living this stuff for a while, you know, talking about this, interviewing people about this, all that. But I care too much what other people think. I mean, is that something that you have navigated in some way?
So this is actually a leadership question, by the way, that threes lead. Threes want you to want to follow them.
Right.
Right. And so my friends who are eights, like, man, they're going to do this. Yeah. You know, get on board or get run over sort of thing.
Right.
Like
right.
This is the way it's going.
Yeah.
But threes don't lead that way.
Yeah.
Threes are in our culture, probably some of the last people who actually still believe in persuasion. And if you're coming along for the ride, we want you to want to come along for the ride.
Right. Right.
And sometimes that means, sometimes that leaves us in stasis when we should be moving because we're waiting for everyone to get on board because the relationship, because remember threes are in the heart triad, right? And so like relationships mean a ton to us,
right?
In ways that they don't to people in the body and the head triads.
Yeah.
And so when threes really actually need to listen to twos talk about what it's like to be a two in their relationships, because we're actually not that far from it.
Hmm.
And when you are in that space, you are willing to, and because threes are so practical and efficient, you're willing to sacrifice personal virtues and values for the sake of the relationship, because what you want most is the relationship. And to lose people, to lose a person is to be unsuccessful in the relationship.
Right.
Lots of folks for different reasons aren't worried about having successful relationships in certain ways. And so, yeah, it absolutely does. Like there's a conversation that I have needed to have with a couple of people about some racial issues that I just haven't, partly because COVID has put a strain on a relationship and I don't feel like we enjoy the same sort of intimacy and connection that we used to. But part of it is because I know that it could be really bad relational fallout, not just for me, but for other people as well.
Right.
And I want to handle those situations well, but some of it I have to confess, like, is allowing those things to keep me from moving where I need to move. And that happens quite a bit. I mean, that's right. One of the things that I liked about pastoring a small church where there was a lot of alignment is that there just wasn't a lot of tension. And I would have, right. I will willingly trade lack of tension. I'll trade growth for lack of tension. Like
right.
we can stay this size and not grow, but man, it's not tense at all. And I enjoy that.
Right. Which pushes back on like a threes whole thing, right? I mean, like threes are seen as like success being the sort of only metric that matters, but that success isn't necessarily like it's the success that you think is valuable as opposed to like, it's not necessarily like making tons of money and like, you know, having all the things. It's what success that you feel like sort of completes you. And yeah.
Right. And I wonder sometimes if it's not so much success as it is lack of failure.
Right.
So, I mean, a three will do whatever to avoid failure.
Yeah.
But the message that threes are telling themselves is that I am good if I do something valuable.
Right.
And that could be a whole lot of different things, right? So you're exactly right. It's for some, it's making the next sale, earning certain kind of living in a certain kind of neighborhood. But if you're in a helping profession, like you might have a completely different view of what's valuable. Right. And we want to, what success and competence and effectiveness looks like varies from context to context.
Right. Yeah, for sure. So I'm seeing a spiritual director now. I got an, he's Enneagram certified and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. I literally told him the other day that I would probably prefer death to failure. I mean,
like it feels like death. It feels like death.
It does. It does. It's, yeah, it's very hard to even like put into words, like how afraid of failure, I actually am.
And so, and what's at the heart of that is not, oh man, I failed. Cause I, another eight that I work with, like she would say, like I make mistakes all the time. And like,
right.
You know, the fear there is if I am loved because I am successful.
Right.
So if I am not successful, I will not be loved. And other numbers can hear a three say that and go, that is ridiculous. Of course you will. But we don't believe it. And just like, if you were to walk up to an eight and say to them, you will not be betrayed, right? You can say that and you can say, why are you worried about that? That's not happening. They will struggle to believe it. And nice. I don't think what I want folks to hear is like, these aren't just things that people say and need to get over. Those fears, what we hazard, what we seek to avoid, are in our bones. Like they are deep.
Yeah, they're inescapable. Yeah. They feel like it a lot of times. So I know you lead you know, a lot of people. You do a lot of work. How does your understanding of Enneagram play into how you were able to lead others?
Yeah, so I think part of that is because I think stances, Enneagram stances, are like the hidden jewel within the Enneagram system. One, because my memory does not work well enough to remember all the nuances of all nine numbers.
Sure, right.
But I can remember that three numbers are in the withdrawn stance, three numbers are aggressive or assertive, and three numbers are dependent. And so we marry up triads. So triads and stances, triads tell you what you're dominant in and your stance tells you what you're repressed in. And so when I know someone well and we're working together, and I'm sure this is what your spiritual director is helping to work you through, is like, oh, there are some things that are going to be just come to you super easy.
Right.
And there are some things that are going to be really hard. So just to keep it kind of in the three lane, I know threes are going to be feeling dominant and feeling repressed, which means
right,
like we're feeling everything that's in the room. We're feeling what other people are feeling, but we can't tell you what we're feeling. Right. Someone asked me that the other day. They said, how are you feeling? And I told them, ask me in a year about today, and I will have more clarity about what I'm feeling today than I have today.
Right.
Yeah. And so what that means is then, like, I've got to do some things to help people feel and to make it okay for them to feel. So like as a three, and there's an entry in the book about this too, like one of the reasons that threes don't tell people how they don't explore how they're feeling is because after a while, we don't really care how other people are feeling. Like we only care how they're feeling insofar as getting the next thing done. Right. If it's a hindrance or a help to get the next thing done.
Right.
But other than that, we're like, man, when you, like you show up for work, like we've got to do X, Y, and Z today. It doesn't matter how we feel about it.
Right.
And the reason we're that way toward other people is because we're that way toward ourselves. Like, it doesn't matter how I feel. Like, lawn's got to get mowed. The taxes have to get done or whatever. Like, I don't want to do it. Like, that's irrelevant.
Right.
But we, over time, place everything in that irrelevant box. Like, all those feelings are irrelevant. And so if I'm working with somebody, I've got to work through that. When I'm speaking to groups or congregations, like I got to know in the room that there are people who are thinking dominant, feeling dominant, and doing dominant, right? And so I need to hit all of those motivators And if I leave someone out, then that's not going to be an effective message for them. Mm-hmm. If we're constructing something, some project, I need some people to deploy their thinking, some to deploy the doing, and some to deploy their feeling. But I also need to help those same people to bring up the thing that they are repressed in so that they can do a better job of living full lives.
Yeah, that's helpful. I always think, you know, like typing people, you know, when you sort of, right. Like it's easy to sort of like, oh, they're a blah, you know, and it's so hard to tell motivation.
Right.
You know, you can't really know, but those stances give you sort of a picture of You're probably in this zone. And I think for me, aggressive is like by far the easiest. You know, like I know, like you're a 3, 7, or 8, like, like off the bat. The other ones are harder for me to like distinguish between, I guess. But I always find that to be a helpful way to think about it, I guess. So
yeah, I agree with that. For me, knowing the aggressive stance, and it may just be because I am in the aggressive stance. So like, I just I recognize that. Yeah, I find it a little bit easier to discern. But here's, you know. Typing people is never good, but you know that the stances are always represented, right? And so if you can learn to work with stances, especially in groups, you'll have a little bit more success instead of trying to figure out. Because once you get into the Enneagram, you know, people who are critics will say, how are there only 9 types of people in the world? Well, that's not really what the Enneagram is saying.
Right.
It's a place to start, and then that fractures down, and there's so many nuances. Then people's own life story comes into play. And it's, you know, it's much more complex than just 9 types of people. And you don't want to have to do that with someone that you don't know well and aren't who lacks that language. And one of the things that I have come to, and this may not be completely correct, but I don't see the Enneagram as a thing in and of itself.
Right.
I see the Enneagram as a language that we talk about things. You could know people and yourself really well, and you could know the nuances of the Enneagram and live on the backside of the earth someplace that hardly anyone ever goes to and not know Enneagram language. So there's nothing you can talk about with the Enneagram that you can't talk about without the Enneagram. But the shared language is really helpful, and it's really great to have an understanding about how it gives a language to a system about how real things operate in the world. It's not out there operating on its own, is what I mean by that.
Right. Yeah. I've heard it talked about sort of like as ways of viewing the world. Like there's 9 different sort of ways of lenses or whatever. But if you like if people critique that, then just imagine there being thousands of different ways of viewing the world. I mean, How would we ever like accomplish anything, I guess, you know? So my first question is, what is the strangest job that you have ever had?
I've not had a lot of strange jobs. I worked at a bowling alley. That was a decent job. Worked at a bowling alley in college. That wasn't very hard. And I also worked as a telemarketer, but it was fundraising. So that was an interesting job, but I think those probably are if anything's odd about those, it's just for hours. What was interesting about the telemarketing job was that you sat in front of a computer and you made phone calls for 4 or 5 hours at a time, but you had to wear a shirt and tie for that job. I never understood. And it got to a point where I was making so much money. I was raising so much money, and you'd get these little rewards, like a free dress day or something like that. And if you worked in the daytime, because it was all the calls were at night when people were at home, but they would have some leftovers, like, oh, call me at my office, that sort of thing. And you could work in the daytime. You didn't have to dress up. You could just wear whatever you wanted. But I got to a point where I was making so much money, raising so much money, that I just quit wearing the shirt and tie altogether. And like, my boss never said anything.
That's legit. Like, and that's when you know you've made it.
And like, we had reward. I mean, like, we had reviews. Like, and they would come and say, "This is how much time your average call is. This is how much your rate making." And as you worked there longer, you got into bigger donors,
right?
And so, and it never even came up in a review. And so I was like, "Well, forget that." I don't know why the rest of you are girls are in dresses and skirts. Guys are in shirt and tie. And I'm like, yeah, I'm not doing this.
I love it. I love it. Okay. So my final question then is, what is one piece of advice you would give to somebody looking to bring God's kingdom more into their work?
This is really counterintuitive, because when you say God's kingdom, it feels so big for everyone.
Sure.
I would suggest you start, and I don't know how you do this in COVID times, but there are ways. Having lunch with people, sitting down with people and having long conversations with them about their lives. Mm-hmm. Most folks never get to talk about their lives in meaningful ways. And so we just kind of get headlines. And what you begin to see when we actually start listening to people is where God wants you to bring his presence in the lives of other people.
Yeah.
And so if you're looking for a one-time in and out sort of a thing, that's going to be really hard. But like, there are people, I mean, everyone is hurting in some deep ways. If you want to be God's presence and bring God's kingdom, you have to know where people really live, not what's just, oh, this is happening. This is going on. This is, you know, she had surgery, that sort of thing. But begin with deep listening. And I've always told preachers that a week's worth of lunches will give you a year's worth of sermons. The same is true for all of us. Like, we get a bigger picture of where God is calling us to be and the spaces he's calling us to inhabit by listening to where people are.
Yeah, that's really good. I really appreciate that. That's a lot of years of pastoral ministry all sort of going into that. So that's, I appreciate that. Sean, it was so good to talk to you. Thank you for the wisdom. And I'll be hanging out with you for at least 25 days.
So, yeah. That's right. Well, thank you for having me, and thanks for reading the book. I hope it's a blessing to threes and threes adjacent and people who love threes, who are also your listeners. So thanks for having me.
Well, I hope you enjoyed hearing from Sean. And if you know a three or in your life, this is a great Christmas present maybe to go pick up 40 Days on Being a Three. Check out the show notes. All that info is there for you. It's helpful to know things about ourselves. And this book really delves into what being a three is like. Go check out the other titles from that series from IVP. Really, really good stuff that they got going on there. Now is a great time to go to the bottom of your iTunes app. You can leave a rating and review for me there. Just to let people know that you're listening to A Theology of Hustle. It helps get the word out. And I just love hearing about the stuff you're enjoying about the podcast. So go do all that for me. And until next time, get out there and hustle.